When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly Podcast. It's been a massive week in English cricket. Joe Root has resigned as England's Test captain after 64 tests in the job, and Rob Key has been appointed as the ECB's new Managing Director of Men's Cricket. Later on in the show, we'll be talking about the 159th edition of the Wisden Almanac that is out today, as well as a brand new issue of Wisden Cricket Monthly. We've also got another round of County Championship action and some IPL drama to digest. I'm Yaz Rana, and our team to talk through all that today is the Editor-in-Chief of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Phil Walker, former England batter Mark Butcher, and the Wisden Editor, Lawrence Booth. Let's start with the news of Root's resignation. Joe Root captained England more times in Test cricket than anyone else. He led England to more Test victories and more Test defeats than any other England captain. Lawrence, how do you think his reign should be remembered?
I think as a good bloke, a popular leader, a heavy run scorer who didn't quite have all the ingredients to be a very successful Test captain. I think what summed him up in a way was in August he became England's most victorious captain, and in December he became their most defeated. So in the same year he tasted the highs and lows, and that sort of summed him up a bit. There were wins here, losses there, but no real thread to it. And by the end it became unsustainable. He won one Test out of 17 and he didn't win an Ashes, which, like it or not, is how a lot of England cricket captains get remembered. Mike Gatting won two Tests out of 21 as captain. They're both in the 86-87 Ashes, and that's how he gets remembered to a degree. So, look, he goes out with the thanks of English cricket, great guy, but in the end, various factors proved too much for him. His own lack of tactical acumen, I'm afraid to say, one of them.
But we talked about it before in the show, but England's biggest problem in the last 2 years has been they've not scored enough runs. How much blame can be attributed to Root for that?
Well, none, really. I mean, his own form has been nothing short of spectacular, given the paucity of assistance that he's had around him in the last three or four seasons. And so, you know, it's extraordinary, really, a real testament to sort of his professionalism and his clarity of thought and his damn talent, really, as a batsman, that he's been able to keep such high standards when all around him were falling apart. You know, I agree with a lot of what Lawrence has said about the sort of the tactical acumen, some of the big decisions, some of the sort of decisions around selection, around the way that the team was set up to play, you know, decisions around you know, being able to turn a winning position into a losing one, which became absolutely sensational at by the end, were things at all which did him no favours whatsoever. But he was captaining with at least one hand behind his back, and maybe half a leg as well at times, given that the team just simply could not put any runs on the board. He also had a lot of injuries to contend with major bowlers, which every England captain has had to deal with ever since I've started being involved. So that's not so much of an excuse. However, I think the time of it. He's been there for longer than anybody else. And I'll never forget the look in his eye. I bumped into him as he was on his way up to his room on the way back after the last day of the Grenada Test match. He just looked absolutely shot to bits. Absolutely shot to bits. Ruined. And, you know, that conversation around, well, who else? You know, who else? If not Joe Root, who else? Well, that kind of doesn't matter, I don't think. I think you have to... The game will move on and you'll find somebody to fill that spot. There being a paucity of other options is no reason to keep a man in a job. The only reason to keep him in the job is if you feel that he still has enough to give, or at least that the messages that he is sending out are strong enough to make a change in the team. And I'm afraid, because of the way that the same mistakes occurred again and again and again and again, you have to say, time's up, Joe. And thank you very much for everything you've done before that moment, because he's been a terrific ambassador for English cricket. But it was time.
Phil, one win in 17 is a stat that followed Root out the door, and it's easy to forget there were some good times in those 64 tests as well. 4-1 win over India in 2018, following that with 3-0 win in Sri Lanka, winning South Africa.
The South Africa tour felt like a bit of a hinge point as well, because they went down in that first test match, came back to win that
series.
With
a very young squad as well.
Yeah, there have been some high point moments. There have been outbursts of optimism through his story. And it would be, I think, unfair and a bit churlish if the kind of abiding motif of the Root era is, as Mark describes, that kind of broken hangdog, energy sapped, 1,000-yard stare Root that we got towards the end of Grenada. And you can't imagine what the toll of the last 4 or 5 months on a human level must have taken out of the bloke. You know, exhausted by, you know, the revolving door of failures, pick another, comes in, can't do it. The sense that he's only rarely, if ever, been able to get his full team out on the park. Obviously, there are extraordinary circumstances around his tenure. You know, captaining during COVID is it blows your mind how complicated that must have been. You know, just not just on a personal level, but obviously on a strategic level. How do you hope to get everything out of your test side when you're often denuded of certain players that you need? He had the Ben Stokes problem last summer when Ben had to take a bit of time out of the game. You lose your talisman, best player. So there's all kinds of caveats, none of which is to say that his time hadn't come, and that we do arrive by, you know, sort of chaos, really, at a point which needed to happen. It probably needed to happen after the Ashes. I personally felt if he could go to the well one more time, considering what the circumstances were, then take him to West Indies, see if he can build something else. I think he's run out of steam. He's probably run out of spirit as well. But, you know, I think we're kidding ourselves if we think replacing the leader guarantees better days, because there are all kinds of other factors at play here, over and above his qualities or otherwise as a strategist and a leader.
Just to what, Mark, you said about English cricket owing a lot to Joe Root, if you go back to when Alistair Cook resigned, there weren't many standout options for at the time. And, you know, you look now, part of the reason possibly why Root has gone on so long is there weren't any standout options to replace him.
But what was interesting about that time is that he wasn't just the best candidate or the only candidate. He was a really good option. Most people, with the exception actually of Graham Swann, who said, let him bat. But everybody else said, look, he's sparky, he's intelligent, he's obviously got great class as an individual, he's popular. People will want to play for him. He'll be able to pull a dressing room together by sheer dint of sort of decency as much as anything else. And he was full of bubbling with ideas. You just see the way that he bats. He's not a person who doesn't understand the workings of a cricket match. It's almost like the job wears you down. It makes you more pragmatic, more kind of risk averse.
You know, that is a really, really interesting point, because I was thinking about this yesterday, that one of the problems and one of the issues around the captaincy of Joe Root has been that despite of all of the caveats, it's still English cricket. It's still 18 teams. You've got this mountain of talent that is sloshing around for white ball cricket. You've got resources that most test playing countries would absolutely die for. And so in the midst of his tenure having been ultimately, I suppose, a disappointment, you still look at it and go, well, crikey, we've still had it better than a lot of other people during this time. And perhaps Joe's sort of lack of, and it wasn't a lack of drive, lack of courage, really. Courage either of his own convictions or courage in the players that he had around him. Admittedly, they let him down often enough for that to have been eroded. To kind of be able to take things by the scruff of the neck and to be a little bit more daring, given the talent at his disposal at times. And I think that's been an issue. You know, the whole thing around Matt Parkinson now is starting to look hilarious, isn't it? The fact that the guy just keeps going on tour, never gets close to getting a game, etc., etc. And I think he would have played. You know, if the Grenada pitch had not looked the way it did in the last one, he would have played in that last Test match, because England had made runs and they just looked so far away from taking 20 wickets that you might as well have a guy out there that they don't particularly trust. But isn't that just, doesn't that
it's still
in
symptomatic
itself,
though, that he didn't play in either
doesn't
of the
that
ones?
Exactly. Doesn't that in itself tell you the whole story, that there was never enough trust Never enough trust in either a young, talented player, perhaps not even enough trust in some of your more senior and gnarled players to kind of to be able to think and make decisions for themselves for the good of the team. Joe took a lot of that stuff on himself and wasn't ultimately didn't have the sort of the strength of personality or the strength of conviction to turn it into you know, a team that was that should never have been the best in the world under his tenure in Test match cricket, but should never be outside the top three, given all of the things that English cricket has at its disposal.
Now that Root has actually resigned, who do you think should replace him?
Well, regrettably, I can only see Ben Stokes as the only candidate. I mean, look, it's not ideal. Like, as Phil said earlier, he missed a chunk of last summer because he's dealing with mental health issues as well as his broken finger. We don't want to have to give it to Ben Stokes. He's got so much else on his plate. It may work if he doesn't play international T20 cricket. I mean, England have got enough big hitters, they've got enough bowlers. It's not his strongest format, weirdly, even though he can tear a game apart himself. And that his ODIs are limited to World Cups, say, and then he can concentrate on Test cricket and play some IPL if he wants. That England should be able to find a way to not overburden him. I mean, of course, the one of the issues with Stokes is he gets injured quite a lot. And that's one of the things that people say, well, you can't pick Broad because he's not in the team and he's a bowler and bowlers get injured more than batsmen. Well, Stokes gets injured because he bowls, he's not supposed to bowl at all, then he bowls 99 overs in the Caribbean, or he bowls bouncers at Sydney and hey presto, he can't bowl in Hobart. So he'd have to manage himself, which would be an interesting one. But look, I can't see who else can do it. You know, there's some ridiculous names been thrown about just from nowhere because we're desperate, but it has to be Stokes.
He said, Lawrence, when he was asked about it was quite a canny response. He says he has no ambition to be Test captain, which was a good line. Obviously, it leaves things open. Do you think, in his heart of hearts, he wants it, or rather he'd be prepared to take it on if and when he's asked?
He was asked about that when Root was in the job and fighting a really difficult Ashes series, and he was just being loyal to his mate. I mean, there was no way he was going to stir the pot and get that debate going.
Do you think he'd want it now?
Yeah.
You do?
I think in private, I mean, you talk to a couple of the journos who know him well, or ghost his columns, they're like, yeah, of course he wants to be England captain. There's no way he's going to say that, undermine Joe Root.
The only concern I have about it, really, is how Ben the Human would cope with that. Because, you know, he's somebody that gives you absolutely everything at face value when he's on duty. But he also is a very human being when he's off duty. And having to change your... Being England captain requires, for some people it's natural because they don't have anything to change. That's the way they are. Alistair Cook didn't have to change anything to become England captain. It wasn't like he was going to suddenly stop rolling out of nightclubs at 3 o'clock in the morning, because he never did it. Never, still doesn't, you know. But for other people, there are certain ways of life, certain freedoms that they enjoy that would have to be curtailed slightly in order to be sort of England's captain. It's not a job for on the field, unfortunately. There is as much of it. It's like an iceberg. More of it is underneath the surface of the water than's on top. And so that's the thing that you worry about for somebody like Ben Stokes taking on that job on a permanent basis. You know, I've read things about people saying that, you know, we should perhaps do it on a series-by-series basis, or maybe give somebody the captaincy up until the end of the summer and then see how you get along. Which, you know, is kind of sensible, I suppose. Although, if you think about it, what did that do to England's greatest ever all-rounder back in the 80s? He kind of, like, not knowing he was going to captain the team from one game to the next kind of ruined his confidence, his decision-making, the way that you feel that you can express yourself in front of teammates, etc., if your job is always on the line, is impossible. So you can't give the job to somebody on a part-time basis. You have to give the job to them in the hope that they end up doing 40, 50 test matches and then make a decision somewhere down the line. And all of this brings us back to my mate Rob Key, doesn't it? I mean, here is a guy who is in his first ever managerial role. He's been captain of a club before. First ever managerial role where you're hiring, firing, you're doing all of the sort of the bureaucratic stuff. He finds himself in a job as director of cricket where none of the positions, not even his boss, is decided. He doesn't even know who he's answering to yet. And so, you know, perhaps the captaincy is the least of English cricket's worries right now.
Mm. On Stokes, I guess I don't really know how a vice-captain-captain dynamic works, but Root's been criticised a lot for a lot of decisions that he's either made or been part of the decision-making process. How much influence does a vice-captain have? Because if Root's getting criticism, wasn't Stokes there to influence dressing room culture and also to actually influence those decisions? Actually, Joe, I think Saqib should play the first test in West Indies, for example.
Well, yeah, for sure, but the captain makes the final call, always. I mean, there are... there are parallels in other walks of life where you might say that the underlings get thrown under the bus and the boss sticks out. I can't think of it. Can anybody think of anything at the moment that's pertinent on that?
Also Stokes won't back down from a tricky decision, will he? You know, no. I mean, the first and only Test match he's capped. I think it's the only one he's Test match. He dropped Broad straight off the bat, didn't he? He said, "Well, you're not playing me straight away." I don't think he's going to back down in the way that Root might have prevaricated a little bit here and there hedged his bets.
The captain always carries the can for this stuff, and it's right to because the last thing you want. Being in a job where it is so high profile and every decision you make is pored over, the last thing you want is to be hung, drawn and quartered for a decision that somebody else has made. So regardless of whether Ben had any input in any of that stuff, it's Joe's call. Always. Always.
Are you not tempted by anyone else other than Stokes?
Frankly, no. I mean, you know, that I suppose if you're looking at somebody to do it on a less than permanent basis, and I've already said that I think that's a pretty daft idea, then you might sort of say, well, you know, Stuart, last hurrah for the summer, do you fancy leading the team out against two top sides in the Test match arena? That throws up all kinds of interesting internal dynamics. I mean, he'd be good at it, you know, and the press conferences would be fun. How often can you say that? Yeah. But I don't know. I mean, you know, James Vince's name keeps getting brought up. I mean, everyone, particularly my learned friend over there, our editor in chief, would love to just see him back in the side anyway. But as captain, I mean, goodness gracious, is there enough Kleenex in the country if something like that were to happen?
I've stopped short of backing that idea. For the record,
you know, people
well short of that.
People mentioning people like Rory Burns, obviously county captains, you know, all of a sudden become sort of viable options, I suppose, by dint of the fact that they're leaders anyway. The issue with everybody is that no one's permanent in the side. The only person, and maybe Johnny Bairstow is the other one at the moment. The only person you could say has any air of permanence in the team for whatever reason, in whatever position, is Ben. He's the only one.
Which is wild when you say that. Yeah.
He's the only one.
Yeah. Rob Key was asked this question a few months ago, and he said for his money, pound for pound, you know what I'm going to say, that he thinks that Joss Butler would have been an interesting successor, a natural successor to Root at a certain point in the story. That point has almost certainly gone. But if we were sitting around here...
And he's smashing hundreds in the IPL for fun at the moment.
He is,
you know?
But that shouldn't
he's
necessarily...
He's enjoying himself in a way that he never enjoyed himself playing Test match.
Sure, but that shouldn't necessarily negate the conversation, which would be... very much being had if we were talking 6 months ago. And he had a bad Ashes. Everyone had a bad Ashes. And we assume that door is shut. And if it is, then we leave it aside. But it's interesting that the bloke now, who's going to make the call, identified what many others had as well, in fairness, last year. You know, that
he said that after the Ashes, in fairness to Key.
Was it after the Ashes?
It was after the Ashes on that podcast. Yeah.
Right.
Interesting. So what's the position?
What, on Rob Key?
Yeah, no, the position.
He thinks that Joss Butler would have been...
He said he was the best
the most
captain.
Natural, but,
yeah. I mean, you say...
Strategic successor
In the midst of what you were saying there about, you know, the door being... There's no door should be closed, really, at the moment. We're in such a state of... It's not flux, even, is it? It's such a state of openness that there shouldn't be any... That nothing should be dismissed as out of hand. You know, there are, as far as I can see it, there should be lots of senior-ish batters, you know, sort of 29 to 32-year-old batters in county cricket thinking, I've got half a chance of getting a four-year shot at Test match cricket. There should be everybody out there at the moment should be thinking that it's open for them. And if Joss, I guarantee you, if Joss Butler suddenly started making noises from the IPL that, yeah, you know what, I feel refreshed, I want to get back into the Test match side and leadership, yeah, I'd give that a shot. If he said that, then why the hell not? Do you know what I mean? But the feeling was by the end of the Ashes series that he was done with the whole thing. And it's instructive that he's out there now smashing the thing to all parts and having the time of his life. And not, I bet he hasn't given it a second thought.
Yeah, he probably hasn't. But he didn't personally declare that he was done with Test cricket. He's not.
He didn't have to. He just had to watch it.
Sure, but we can assume that on many players come the end of a bruising series. Butler's completed white ball cricket. He's done it. He's completed that. Whatever happens to Butler from here on in, he's already one of the greats. If we were to have this bizarre chain of events that then gets him back in that test team, then what he's doing now doesn't negate the validity of him being a part of that conversation again, I don't think. You know, and we play very little 50 over cricket now. We don't have another World Cup for, 3 years in 50 over cricket. He doesn't have to hit another white ball.
50 over World Cup next year.
Sorry, next year. Yeah. He doesn't have to hit another white ball to be our best T20 player for the next 6 months if he doesn't want to. He will always have that, and he's not going to lose his impact, particularly as a white ball player, whether he plays another red ball game or not. So I don't think that the two are necessarily so distinct. You know, I think that there can still be a story that plays out with Butler. I'm not predicting it. I'm not saying that I back it, but I can see it. I can see how that still plays out.
It'll be interesting to see what happens. I mean, the moment Ben Folkes made a mistake in the Caribbean, people go, oh, hang on a second. the best wicketkeeper in the world? What? Bring back Joss Butler. That, and if he doesn't score runs, you know, that narrative could grow. Butler's making county runs or continues to make IPL runs. I mean, one of the interesting characters is Rory Burns, I think, because a couple of years ago, I think they did see him as a future test captain. And then the word seems to be that he goes a bit quiet in the dressing room and didn't kind of develop naturally as the leader, the guy with inputs into discussions that they'd hoped. So he sort of fell away, and so did his runs. I think the thing with Stokes is, can he avoid the trap that a lot of England captains, I think, fall into, including Joe, which is they go down the conservative route. They make safe, what they regard as safe decisions. So Chris Wokes opens the bowling in Australia when we know he's not an away bowler. And then they take him to the West Indies and he's opening the bowling in the West Indies with Craig Overton. Now, most people could tell you that wasn't going to work. Parkinson, as Butch mentioned, is a classic example of English conservatism. Let's pick the left-arm spinner, bowl 60 overs, 3 for 110, landing it on the same spot again and again, but wasn't going to bowl West Indies out. English cricket is... conservatism is its default mode, I think, historically, and it's often needed an outsider to come in. You look at our most successful coaches, Duncan Fletcher, Zimbabwean, Andy Flower, Zimbabwean, Trevor Bayliss won a World Cup as an Australian, Owen Morgan's an Irishman, took us to the first World Cup, Kevin Peterson was the first guy who played switch it, and so on. You often need a kind of an outsider, and I think Stokes temperamentally, if not geographically, is an outsider, and the key for him, if he were to be captain, would be to keep that sort of devil. You know, the Headingley 2019 devil in him. That gives English cricket the best chance.
Yeah, bang on. And just on that, in Rob Key's book, which we might come to later, actually, because it's become a very useful source, you know, a secondary text. But he speaks about his admiration for Bayliss and for, you know, attacking, thrusting Red Bull cricketers. And, you know, makes a very key-like point on that, you know, how much value is it really to sort of graft out 15 or 20 in 120 balls, really? No. Right. Yeah. Okay. This is what you're saying.
Oh, however, what I will say, and I because this needs to come in early before you get to the crux of your point, is that England kind of went so far, the pendulum swings so far one way and then so far in the other direction. You get blocking the crap out of it from one coach and you get smashing it to all parts from another. Yeah. And yet, you know, Test match cricket is so much more nuanced than that. You need players who have the ability to be able to do all of those things. Yeah. And therein lies the danger in thinking, okay, everything needs to be gung-ho. No, you need some glue in there. You need some people who are going to be able to chisel out runs. You'd quite like them to have the gears to go up and down if they can, but you know, you need the glue, but you also need the flair and the flamboyance. You need people who can unlock batting lineups on very, very flat pitches. None of which we had in the Caribbean. I mean, crikey. Woo.
Yeah.
Talk about, you know, I think I might have said on the commentary about, you know, the sleepless nights waiting to open the batting in the Caribbean on my first trip in 97, 98 with Lambros and Walsh. And I'm thinking, mate, I'd have been up all night. Wokes and Overton, sorry. No disrespect to either of them, but my God, it was the friendliest opening bowling stuff I've ever seen in a test match in the Caribbean.
Moving on, the other big piece of news this week was that Rob Key has been unveiled as the new managing director of men's cricket. You might have heard that by now. I've seen a lot of people bemoaning his lack of experience, which is obviously not an unfair observation, but who is experienced and qualified for this role? Being the managing director of a county is completely different to being the managing director of whole of English men's cricket. I mean, Mark Ramprakash wrote a piece in The Guardian yesterday, new WCM columnist, where he said that English cricket should have been looking for names who are outside the box, like Rob Andrew at Sussex, Clive Woodward, Mo Bobat, Paul Farbrace, or Vikram Solanki, who he mentioned has a law degree. But It's not going great at Sussex. Woodward has nothing to do with cricket. Mo Bobat has never had a public-facing role or has played professional sport. Farbrace isn't exactly out of the box, and I'm not sure what a law degree's got to do with a job. I mean, like a lot of people have been talking about Key's lack of experience, but his experience. I mean, no, Jars was experienced and had relevant experience and didn't do the job that well.
I think in terms of talking about experience, it's not experience of doing that role, clearly, because there are no jobs like it. Yeah. Are there? It's experience outside of the sort of the playing and punditing or captaining environment, I guess. That's all. I mean, because as I said, it's a management role. It's not a coaching role. It's a role that requires sort of perhaps political skills as much as anything else. But one thing I would say that Keezy has in abundance, and something that I think is going to stand him in really good stead, is the fact that he is as far removed from the sort of like the ECB sort of, the identikit ECB blazer wearing pick that you might think. He's very much his own man in terms of his way of thinking, and he possesses a very, very healthy dose of cynicism, which I love in people. I don't know why, but he has the ability to be able to look around and behind things and look at them from angles that perhaps other people, other candidates might not. But I think the criticism of his lack of experience in jobs outside of, you know, the things that we know that he's done is a genuine concern and criticism. And I kind of, you know, I sort of shiver a little bit thinking about him going into that world and thinking, well, I hope he goes okay in there because it's a long way away from what he's done. So I don't dismiss that criticism at all. But I also think that he brings qualities perhaps that have been attractive in a world whereby conservatism is kind of, you know, and sort of thinking very much within that boring old envelope has been prevalent in English cricket, and he will, with any luck, if he's himself, then that will not be the case. So it could be good fun to watch.
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole thing about him not having any managerial experience is a very English concern. It's what can't he do? Rather than what can he do? I think the main problem for English cricket for the last 2 years is they've been planning for this mythical future which never quite arrives, and they sacrifice the present. I mean, they sacrificed several series before the Ashes for the Ashes, then they sacrificed the first Ashes test for the third Ashes test. By the time they got around to the, you know, it was an absolute disaster. They were always planning for a future which never quite got there. And I think Key is a straight talker. He will cut through that BS, basically. He'll say, look, the
you can
best
swear
way
on this show, by the way.
Okay,
well, just throw it out.
That's me swearing. he will understand a very basic truth, which is that to get a team winning, you pick the best players in the here and now. You get momentum that way, and then young players can come into a winning side. I mean, what England desperately needed in the Caribbean was a victory, any victory, a scrappy 1-0 just to stop the bleeding, and they dropped Broad and Anderson. I mean, Root brought about his own downfall by doing that. Absolute madness. If Key had been in charge, I cannot see that having happened.
Well, funny you should say that, because I think he quite advocated it. Because he and I, we've become a little bit of a double act when doing county stuff and things on Sky, because we tend to disagree quite often. Now, he thought that his view was that the Caribbean was very much a chance for England to go out there and experiment a little bit and do pretty much what they did. My view was, hell no. We don't win there anyway. Take down the team that has at least got half a sniff of winning, because you cannot lose again. You can't keep losing. You lose people. So you lose the captain. We're now in a situation where we have nobody running anything in English cricket apart from Rob himself. So there was immediately there's a disagreement in view. You know, some of the senior players, I mean, you know, and you have to take everything that the senior players say with a pinch of salt, because a lot of that is around sort of self-preservation. But Stewart would go along and say, well, look, you know, can we try and win the game in front of us and not keep worrying about the future? And other people would look at it and go, well, if you don't look after the future, then you end up blowing everything up anyway. I think, unfortunately, a combination of COVID and a combination of doing too much, with the Ashes being the prime example, of looking at the sort of like the golden, you know, this is our sort of holy grail, has cost us enormously. And if you go back through goodness knows how many of our pods, how often did we call the stuff that was coming? Mm. You know, I don't even want to go back there because it's horrendous.
Do you want to talk about Jack Leach?
What? Yeah, all of the decisions that they were going to end up making, you could see how it was going to go. But they were going about it in a way that was only going to guarantee that it failed in the first place. And you're just watching these car crashes happening in slow motion. Mm. And that's what needs to stop. And it might require somebody to be very, very definite in terms of a vision about how the next at least 6 months go. Be definite about it. And if you're going to throw everybody out, if you're going to chuck the baby out with the bathwater, then do it in spectacular fashion. Maybe do it at home where you stand half a chance of winning and then see how you get on. I wouldn't advise it right now because the public aren't going to take us losing much more often in the near future. So you have to deal with all of this stuff with a healthy dose of pragmatism as well.
Funny you say that, actually. I was speaking to someone this weekend who said he's watched a day of England test match every year for the last 20 years, but he's not going to this time because he liked seeing England win, and he's genuinely not sure if England will win any of the home seven test matches, genuinely.
A mate of mine said to me over the weekend, it's like one of those schmaltzy British films when, in a good way, but when your mate down the pub accidentally becomes the Prime Minister. Now, and he did say in a good way. He did say in a good way. But for all that it does seem like, you know, he stumbled into this position as much as anything else. Nonetheless, don't underestimate the bloke. You know, the bloke knows the game inside out. What, as Mark says, he doesn't yet know is the machinations and the doors that are shut in your face. You have to work with county chairman, county boards, stakeholders. You have to work with all these levels of what is an extremely convoluted and confused setup, really, that works under the title of the ECB. And he's going to have to confront all of that and in the end maintain his sanity and his spirit as well. And going back to the book, and yeah, I don't want to kind of hang him on the book at all because this was actually a different point now on the book, but I reread bits of it over the weekend, and there was some interesting stuff. And again, fair comment overall, but some interesting stuff on 4-day cricket. And I wrote a bit down actually, and he says 4-day cricket as a business is completely bankrupt. It makes no money and costs a hell of a lot to put on compared to other format. Makes zero financial sense. Now, you know, he's not mincing his words, but that's obviously rooted in reality. And then he makes the point that county cricket, championship cricket, only exists because of the money from Test cricket, the English Test team only because of the championship conveyor belt. And so they're kind of locked in this, as he puts it, they're the ultimate odd couple, he describes it as. Now, all of that is fair comment. All of that is fair comment. But you can also say it when you don't have your ECB badge on. And how he navigates these challenges will be fascinating to see. I wish him luck. It might be inspired, this one. It really might be inspired. As Lawrence says, he's nobody's fool, and he's not. He has his own way of understanding the game, and he's very respected within that. He's moved up through the ranks of the punditry world very, very quickly. He looks you in the eye, and he calls it as he sees it. You know, there's an accent there. He's unpretentious. He's approachable. He's likable. He's all the things that traditionally these characters haven't really been. It might be possibly out of, you know, an accident or maybe design, but I think we're being overly generous. It might be an inspired shout.
I'll tell you one thing, though. I have unbelievable respect for him for doing it because the easiest thing in the world is to sit back and criticize other people's decisions or make calls, big calls about things where you have, you know, there's no jeopardy for you in doing so. You know, that is the job of a commentator / pundit. That's what we do. And his life was pretty damn good.
This is it. You can be good at it, but it's not. If you are good, it's an easy life, right? It's a lovely life.
Absolutely. Really, really good. And he, you know, knowing Keezy as I do, and so my moment of the week before you get round to asking is having to scratch all of these tee off times I had booked in with Rob for the next 2 weeks. Is, you know, he's going to put his money where his mouth is.
Yeah, fair play to him.
And that deserves, whatever happens, that deserves an enormous amount of respect. Yep. Good luck, bud.
Lawrence, what's your moment of the week?
Moment of the week. Manus Labuschagne seems to be able to do everything on a cricket pitch. Suddenly he's bowling seam up for Glamorgan against Notts, gets out, I think it was Tom Moores and Ben Duckett in quick succession, opens the door for quite an unexpected Glamorgan win against a Notts side who everyone thinks are going to go straight up. And then Pat Cummins tweets, "Oh God, we're never going to hear the end of this," over a video of the... And that kind of sums up Labuschagne, I think.
Did you see how green the strip was?
Yeah, that details.
Contributed details. To his decision to bowl seam rather than leg spin.
Yeah, he's just taking the piss there, isn't he?
Yeah.
Really. You know, he's seen off the best that we can summon. And yeah, he's just running in and bowling 60 mph. Dobblers. And
it's Australian trolling, isn't it? Of
yeah,
cricket,
it is. Basically. Exactly that.
He's seen Darren Stevens bowl. He's like, I can do that.
Anybody can do this.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll say no more.
Actually, it should be my depressing moment of the week, really.
Phil, what's your moment of the week?
I mean, predictably and obviously, if you want an actual moment, it has to be Parkinson's delivery to Daniel Bell Drummond in a spell where he took 3 for and then he came back and took another one. Took 7 in the match. He went under 2 and over.
Can I just say on this, he was amazing for 2 days. And so I think Matt Parkinson is in a similar position to a backup England goalkeeper. So if you're not the England
What's
number
your
one
moment
goalkeeper,
of the week, yes.
probably that ball to be honest. But
you'd have it.
If you're a backup England goalkeeper, it's only ever your good games that get focus. Your bad games don't get much press attention. And if you're the England number one goalkeeper, it's only your bad games that get media focus and your good games kind of go under the radar. I think this game is a really good example of that with Matt Parkinson. He was really good for 2 days, lots of attention. And on day four, he only took 1 wicket, bowled pretty much all day on a day four pitch, couldn't force a result. It was Hassan Ali that forced a result. They couldn't get Hamidullah Kadri out, who's got a first-class best of 30 before that game. And he didn't bowl that great. He bowled a lot of really bad balls. If that was a test match, people are making their opinions on Parkinson. And I think we big Parkinson up a lot on this podcast, but I just thought it was fair to mention that because that is relevant.
Sure.
And I think if that was on TV and if that was in a test match, I think people would be coming to conclusions, unfair conclusions, sure, about Parkinson. So
I like it. That? And a dose of realism in this on this show when it comes to this boy is obviously useful, no doubt about it, for your credibility as much as anything
else. But he was really
good
on the TV.
But also, he has taken 7 for in his first hit, you know, first hit out mid-April. And that delivery was a beauty. It's not just about Parkinson, though. It seemed like it was a good week for all the pretenders, all the support cast, you know, from Harry Brooke, who made a really good 100 for Yorkshire in a good game that they won. I think they're going to be really strong this year, actually. I'd probably lean towards them if I was going to have to pick a side to win it. Anyway, he made 100. Bracey made a second 100, 2 in 2 games. Tom Haynes made a big double in a game where 3 double centuries from 3 different nationalities. And they say the county cricket's boring. Amazing. Sam Cook bowled well again, took wickets in that ridiculous game, Somerset Essex, where Essex managed to limp home chasing 80-odd for 9. Overton bowled well, took wickets as well, took 13 for looked like a transformed bowler, admittedly on a rather helpful track, Mark, would you say?
Yeah.
Yeah. He doesn't even want to talk about that on the record.
Ben Duckett, 195 as well.
Ben Duckett, yeah, he started really well, hasn't he? Mm. So all of the... Look, it gives an extra sort of frisson, if you like, to the start of the season when we don't know who's going to play. But there's normally only 2 or 3 spots available. There's 8. There's 8 spots available. So yeah, it was a really good round of games with some interesting results, some surprising results. Surrey played really well here to turn Hampshire over, who have been the pre-season favourites, turn them over by an innings. Jamie Overton, he's not in the England reckoning, but he came back with a new action, bowled really well and fast on a good pitch with pace and bounce. So it was a good week. After a underwhelming first week, I thought the champo, I thought last week was excellent, actually.
Another 100 for Ollie Pope at the Oval as well. His ninth.
Don't even bother mentioning it. If he doesn't get one, he's down in the dumps.
His average at the Oval only went up by like a fraction after scoring 100. I think Haynes is a really good player. We've talked about him in the pod a little bit. He averages...
He was in my team, wasn't he? He was in my squad.
Yeah.
In the West Indies.
He averages 53 in first-class cricket since the start of last season. If you go back to 1983, the player who has ended the summer as the leading run scorer in the country, every single one of them has played Test cricket except from Hildreth and Haynes. Hildreth was 31 when he did it. Haynes was 22. I know Haynes is in Division 2 and people use that as something to hold against him, but he's only got six first class hundreds. He's not played that much, but three of them are against Div 1 teams, and he's not played that much against Div 1 teams. And yeah, he's only 23, captain at Sussex. There's not much else he can be doing. I'm not saying at all he should be in the England team now, but I think that development is quite exciting.
Keep one's eyes on him for sure. Yeah.
Also, he also made a 34 ball 41 in the first innings. Now, he might like have made a double 100 to save the game, whatever, on day four.
Batted for 2 days.
34 ball 41, having been in the dirt for 2 days, conceded 500 in the other captain. That is class. Yeah. That is class right there.
we mentioned the Canterbury game a little bit. Lancashire beat Kent by 10 wickets. But we've not mentioned Ben Compton's extraordinary resilience. So he's the grandson of Dennis and the cousin of Nick. And he came agonisingly close to carrying his bat in both innings. He has hundreds in all three of his Kent games so far this season. He's a new signing for Kent. And if you include his brief stint in Zimbabwe earlier this year, he's got five first-class hundreds in six matches in 2022. Incredible. And to be honest, he was quite unlucky not to carries back in the second innings because it was a questionable umpiring decision, let's say that.
I've heard it's an absolute stinker. I haven't seen it.
Yeah, it's not great. It's probably outside the line.
Yeah.
Outside the line and probably high as well. But yeah, he was an
amazing story, that really is.
He was a leading run scorer in the second 11 championship last summer. Come straight into Kent side, just done brilliantly. And Lawrence, as you mentioned, big win for Glamorgan over Division 2 favourites Nottinghamshire. Moving on to the IPL, Josh Butler, we mentioned him already, he became the eighth player to score three IPL hundreds. In the last year, he scored four T20 hundreds. So he's going very well in T20 cricket. The game between Rajasthan and KKR yesterday was brilliant. Lots of changes of momentum. Yuzvendra Chahal took a fifer, including a hat-trick, and looked to have won the game for Rajasthan before Umesh Yadav smashed 20 off a Trent Bolt over to keep the game alive. But Rajasthan just about hung on. Umran Malik, one of Phil's favourites, had a really good week. He took 4 for 28 the other day, including a triple wicket made in the last over of the innings. Dale Steyn, who's working for the Sunrisers, absolutely loves him.
They've said, we don't care about your economy rate. Yeah. Just bowl as fast as you bloody can.
He's listening.
Yeah, he's great.
And there was a brilliant game between Gujarat Titans and CSK. David Miller scored an unbeaten 94 to help Gujarat recover from 48 for 4 to chase down 170 with a ball to spare. At one point, Rashid Khan hit Chris Jordan for 25 in an over late on to keep that game alive.
Do you watch it, Lawrence, every now and then?
Yeah, I do. I'm not sort of anti the IPL. I mean, I think the IPL poses interesting questions for the global ecosystem of cricket, but I do like what I mean.
It's irresistible, though, isn't it?
Well, if Josh Butler's on 50 off 20, you're tuning in, aren't you?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Wherever. You're not missing that.
Down the local rec, you're watching that. Yeah.
There should genuinely be an app where it tells you if there are players of interest batting in the IPO, turn on Moeen's batting.
That's a brilliant shout.
Give it a couple of years, you'll roll that out.
But you get to pick. So you get maybe five players and whatever. So you want Rashid Khan in the middle of a great spell, whatever it is. Yeah. We're going to have a bit of Josh Butler. You have to have a comedy one there as well. When you're somebody that you know is going to get smoked. So you've got to pick a bowler that you think is going to get absolutely battered.
Who do you have in mind, Butch?
There was a guy. He played for Mumbai Indians a lot, and he used to get absolutely killed every single time. His name escapes me now, and I won't embarrass him by saying so, but it was almost guaranteed he was going at tens. Guaranteed. Yeah.
I just like the way that we all had names in our head and none of us were gonna say them. Yeah. That was nice.
But gotta bear in mind our considerable India audience. Callum asks, any discussion on the Cricket World Cup Super League Division 2? Scotland with 4 wins out of 4 in the last week with pod favourite Mark Watt turning up in the last game. Well, of course, I've got to mention it. Scotland won 4 of their last 4 games, 2 wins each over PNG and Oman. The World Cup Super League Division 2, the top 3 teams go into the World Cup qualifier and the bottom 4 teams go into a World Cup qualifier playoff. So PNG, who have won 1 of their 20 games, can still qualify for the World Cup.
Come on, to PNG. Yeah.
I think my old man's just... I don't think I'm out of order saying this, but I think my old man's just been hired by Jersey for their 7 weeks of qualifying.
There's a podcast exclusive.
Yeah.
It's lovely down there as well.
Yeah.
Enjoy that.
So I think he's going to be going to Uganda, Zimbabwe and Jersey. He's got like 7 weeks on the gig with them. So.
Does he get the tax breaks as well? Or is that part?
I should imagine so. I mean, I wonder why he keeps naffing off to the Bahamas all the time.
The new Wisden Almanac is out. By the time this comes out, it will be out. Before we talk about this year's one, do you know a bit of trivia around Butch and the Wisden Cricketer of the Year award?
Oh, crikey, I should do. This is where I get sacked on air. Go on.
Butch has the most England Test caps without having been a Wisden Cricketer of the Year.
Is that right?
Because
when, get him a valedictory one.
When Butch was at his peak, that was in the very short period of time where it was global summer.
Yeah,
global
they went year. 3 years yeah. where they chose. They went globally across the year because I guess 2002 might have been the year when, as in for what you did in 2001 with that the heading yeah. meanings that, under normal circumstances. Yeah, that's quite tough. But he doesn't seem to have lost much sleep over it, I have to say.
Yeah, you bounce back really strongly.
I'm okay. I'm no. all right.
good to know.
That is good stat, though.
First of all, Lawrence, do you want to tell us who the five Wisden Cricketers of the Year are? And also, it's probably worth reminding listeners and viewers what the selection criteria is.
Yes, so you can only be chosen once, and the emphasis is on the previous English summer, which gets a lot of people quite irate, but there we are. It's been going since 1899. The five cricketers are Jasprit Bumrah, Devon Conway, Ollie Robinson, Rohit Sharma and Dane van Niekerk. So two Indians for the first time ever in a five. Yeah, amazingly, actually. You'd have thought there would have been a couple of years when two would have squeezed in, but Rohit basically helped win a couple of the two Test India One at Lords in the Oval with two great innings, and Bumrah helped win both those games on the last day with brilliant spells. I mean, his record overseas is little short of sensational. I think you guys who are here would remember him bowling Bairstow and Pope in quick succession on the last day, which really opened England up. And then at Lords, of course, a couple of weeks earlier when Virat Kohli had said, let's give England 60 overs of hell, and Bumrah was his main weapon, got root out in first over after tea, I think it was, which was really the beginning of the end for England, and was unplayable. I mean, he's got that incredible action. No one could do anything with him, and he's accurate as well as incisive. It took 9 wickets at Trent Bridge, by the way, where India probably would have won if it hadn't rained on the last day. So yeah, an easy choice.
They had echoes, didn't they, of the early 90s, the Wacker and Wasim spells, where there was just something sort of primal about it, really elemental about it, and there was nobody, the greatest players in the world wouldn't have had anything to offer in, you know,
it felt inevitable. That sort of Yorker, he's the off-stump Yorker. It's like, well, you may know it's coming. I mean, I'm no batsman, but you can see the best batsman in the world knowing it's coming and not being able to do anything about it.
Exactly.
That's quite a gift.
And that 80-odd that Rohit made at Lords, one of my all-time favourite innings, I think.
Brilliant.
Because it was freezing cold, dank, overcast, and him and KL Rahul put on one of the great partnerships, really, considering the conditions.
England stuck him in, didn't they? And you thought, well, this is precisely the kind of conditions where India would usually fall in the heat. But Rohit had been... Because India had been there for the World Test Championship final, and they'd had weeks to prepare for England, he just practiced against a swinging, seaming ball in the nets. I mean, you read the piece where Nagraj Gulapudi speaks to him. Oh, sorry, I think it's Anand Vasu actually does this one. Nagraj did Bumrah. It's all about his preparation. So actually, that worked quite well in India's favour. By the time he gets to Lords, he is absolutely grooved. 83.
Which begs the question, really, doesn't it?
Well, yeah.
I mean, those two names Phil just mentioned are my favourite. You know, I pull them out in the pocket every time we start talking about, you know, oh, England can only, you know, they can only concentrate on one format at a time. Well, you know, these are two blokes. One's got two double hundreds and 50 over cricket. The other bloke makes 20 ball T20 hundreds, and yet they played the swinging and seaming ball in Test cricket better than our blokes, hands down. You know, it can be done, folks. You don't.
They had a month to
focus.
It's
not a pigeonhole. Does not have to keep you away from being just good at batting. That's being good at batting.
That's it, isn't it? Yeah.
And just on Rohit, it's a year in which he has grown as a figure in Indian cricket. I mean, 12, 18 months ago, his legacy as a Test cricketer was not secure at all. Now he's one of the best, if not the best, opening batters in the world. And now, very few people would have predicted it a year ago, he is now the India Test captain as well. It's quite a remarkable rise this late in his career.
So, I mean, he was sort of pigeonholed as, you know, world-class, all-time great white ball batsman, you know, two, three, double hundreds, whatever it is. Great home Test batsman. I mean, he basically helped win the series against England, didn't he, with that 160 in the second Test, set them on their way. But never made 100 overseas. In fact, when he got 83 at Lords, we all thought, oh, he's probably missed out. And then that innings at the Oval where, what were they, 99 behind on first innings? I mean, not many teams win from that position in England. And he knuckled down. And then, as you say, to kind of all that soap opera that's always bubbling under the scene between him and Kohli, you know, tension, supposedly their wives don't get on. There's all kinds of gossip columns are filled in Indian papers. And Kohli is now, he's not quite yesterday's man, because he never quite will be, but Sharma has leapfrogged above him. And Kohli's not scoring runs. I mean, Sharma is now the daddy, the batting daddy of that team. And brilliant to watch as well. Brilliantly graceful, isn't he?
Mm. Just on Ollie Robinson, he obviously had a brilliant year, in his first year, first home summer as an England Test cricketer, but obviously he made headlines for the wrong reasons on his first day as a Test cricketer. Was it a reasonably straightforward choice for you to name him as one of the five?
Well, it's an interesting one, and people, I will be asked about this, and it's a fair question. I mean, look, our basic position was that there were a few things. That the tweets were about a decade old, he apologised, and he was suspended. So he kind of, he'd suffered some punishments there, and I didn't feel it was for Wisden to add to his punishments. He kind of done his time. If he'd done the tweets the day before his Test debut, and he'd not said sorry, that's a different matter. Then he becomes very hard to pick, even if he is one of the, you know, the best five players of the summer who hasn't been chosen before, in the English summer. But for me, it wasn't. I could kind of square that with my conscience, if you like, to pick him. And he, you know, the piece Vish Andraja interviews him, and he addresses it. He asks him tough questions, and Ollie himself says this will never go away. I mean, he's aware that he's messed up. They were horrible tweets, a decade old or otherwise. But it was, the timing was terrible, wasn't it? It was the day they all lined up with the anti-discrimination T-shirts, and the ECB had to make an example of him after what they did.
You know, the problem with one of the big problems with this is, and I'm not saying that he's wrong to be picked. And one of the things that people who have been discriminated against will turn around and say, but this is kind of what happens all the time. We get to suffer from. Varying degrees of abuse over the course of our lives, and there isn't really any kind of recourse to sort of to recompense us for that. And yet, people who have been found to have been guilty of this historically or whatever kind of end up coming out okay in the, you know, regardless. And so, if I can give my personal feeling on it, is that I felt that the suspension was utterly right. That the apology could have been, I don't think he needed to have it written down. I think, all of that kind of stuff. I think it was correct that he was suspended from the team. I think it was correct that he was allowed to be picked on merit once he'd served his punishment. But I do feel that kind of, that Wisden in putting him on the front cover as being one of the five is perhaps further than I would have gone in terms of his rehab. I'm quite happy for him to play. I don't know. It sticks in the craw a little bit. And I'm not somebody that has an axe to grind on this front at all. But I do feel representative of a lot of people that do. Yeah. And I imagine that you're gonna come under some heat for it.
I totally respect that. I hope that the balance of all the different articles we have in the book shows where we stand on things like that. And we've got Azim Rafiq writing at the front of the book about his experience. I'm very critical of Yorkshire and the ECB about the way they handle all of that. Full of praise for Rafiq. Racism is front and centre of the editor's notes. As I say, had Robinson done what he did the previous week and not shown contrition, that for me is a different scale of offence.
Oh, for sure, but he wouldn't have played for England again if that had been
no,
the case.
He wouldn't. But he also said, by the way, to Vish that he wishes he'd been more from the heart in his. He's basically comes off the field. He's told that the tweets have re-emerged, and has a statement thrust under his nose, which he then has to read out like a startled rabbit in front of the national media. He damn right he had to read it out. Damn right he had to say something about it. I get that, and I do take on board your point. I mean, the white mainstream of English cricket hasn't listened enough. It's generally taken the position that, well, we can't see any racism, therefore it doesn't exist. That's very much not the general tone of Wisden. But I totally
no,
accept
it
your point.
Isn't. But you do understand what I'm saying.
I do,
in terms
I do.
Of because just the optics of it are that okay, all is forgiven. There you go. You're away. I mean, I think, as I said, I have no issue with him being back in the side. None of whatsoever. He's served his punishment for it. But I think you have to be very careful about the gongs you hang around people, given the problematic nature of what's happened. And on the one hand, you've got Sid Lawrence as president of Gloucestershire after the revelations that he made during the course of the last couple of summers. That's something that probably wouldn't have happened. Perhaps should have happened. Probably wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been for the last couple of years. And so, I don't know. I think the way that the white the right established side of English cricket kind of paints this issue or kind of either chooses to confront it head on or chooses to kind of allow it to slide is really important in the way that the whole conversation moves forward.
I mean, the piece he does with Vish, it's central to his story. Right. We're not hiding away from it. No. I mean, it's the first few paragraphs. So we're not pussyfooting around it.
Right, tell us why he was picked then.
He was picked because he bowled extremely well. Mm. I mean, he was a leading wicket taker in the England India series in his second series, wasn't it? Because he took wickets on his debut against New Zealand and was then suspended, rightly so, for Edgbaston, and then comes back and bowls beautifully for 2 fifers, 21 wickets. The fitness issue is going to carry on hanging over him because he then goes to Australia, averages 25 with the ball, which wasn't bad, but keeps limping off the field. And then he's not fit to bowl at all in the Caribbean when England hoped he helped succeed Broad and Anderson. So that is another part of his story which sort of overtakes slightly what he did last summer.
I think on the interview with Vish, it's probably not the right word. I was quite impressed by his self-awareness in it. There are other examples of cricketers at the moment who have done bad things in the past, and there are questions about whether they should be forgiven, whether they should pay for it. I think there is a self-awareness there that I thought was quite impressive, and I don't think he'd got across before this interview. I might be wrong. He's spoken to the press before, but possibly not as openly.
Interesting you say that. I mean, I hope Vish doesn't mind me saying this, but I sort of had to talk Vish into doing the piece because his worry was what Butch has articulated, which is, well, in a way, did he want to be tainted with celebrating a guy who'd done racist, sexist tweets? I did persuade him that actually this is a way of addressing the issue. It's not celebrating what he did. It's giving him a chance to express himself and to say sorry and hopefully be an example for other people. But it's thorny, of course it is. It's very difficult, and I totally hear what Butch says.
Obviously, the COVID year brought its own challenges, but otherwise, was this your most challenging year as Wisden editor, given all the grim off-field stuff that happened to English cricket?
Yeah, it probably was. I mean, it's the 11th edition I've done, and I ended up going out to cover the Ashes at the last minute, which, in terms of the workload and getting Wisden done, was a challenge as well. But the issues at stake were tricky because racism hung over the English game like the sort of sword of Damocles, basically, and there was no getting away from that. And the test team was falling to pieces. So, I mean, in the notes, I'm not kind on Tom Harrison, I'm afraid. I've brought up the bonus that he and some of his colleagues will take at the ECB, and I've said this doesn't look good. I mean, English cricket is Tom Harrison has to go in front of Parliament, or at least the DCMS committee, every 3 months to update them on the fight against racism in English cricket. That's not a good position for an ECB chief exec to be in. Hasn't worked off the field, and it certainly hasn't worked on the field, and yet they're pocketing, said to be, 2.1 million between them because they got the 100 through. Now, at a time when 62 ECB employees were sacked last year, when we were told that was rationalising the sort of financially struggling body to pull through, everyone was in it together. For the chief exec then to be pocketing quite a lot on top of a basic salary of $500,000, I don't think that plays that well with fans, a lot of whom are already angry about the way the Red Bull game has been marginalised. So, yeah, I've gone for Tom Harrison. I think he should either give the money back or put it into the ACE programme. If English cricket's serious about dealing with racism, that would be good use of the money, certainly better than being taken out of the game.
You know what? I've just figured out what's sitting badly with me on it about this whole thing at the minute. And it's there are lots and lots of people who, over the course of the last 2 years, have kind of have been able to take a look at or take stock at certain behaviours or certain things that they've allowed to pass, certain ways that they've treated people. And thought, you know what? I want to make a change here. I want to be better. I want to encourage other people to be better. We want to be more inclusive. All this kind of stuff. Fabulous, right? Because there are people. Lots of people can be reached in terms of taking a closer look at the way that they treat other people. But there are lots of people who don't want to hear it at all. And the thing that is sticking in my craw a bit about his nomination and his celebration in this way is that those people, the people who you can't reach anyway, will turn around and take that as a win for them. that's what that I think. I've just been kind of sat here wondering why I'm kind of getting this sort of physical reaction to the idea. And again, it's got nothing to do with Ollie Robinson per se. It's the way that people who have no interest in listening to the idea that there might be some discrimination in the game of cricket or any sort of discrimination in the UK on any format whatsoever. You can't change their minds anyhow. But what you can do is you can give them a little nugget to hang on to and go, well, you know what? It wasn't that bad after all. See, we were right. There was no case to answer. And that's what bugs me about it.
I hope once you read the piece that you agree we've not presented it in that way.
No. But what I'm saying to you is the very fact that he's one of the five, because most of those people won't read the piece either. That's my point. You don't get to them. They don't come to you anyway. They're not interested in listening to the other side of the story. Do you understand what I mean?
I absolutely do. Now, what I'd say is that type of person is quite hard to change their minds anyway. It's confirmation bias. They will leap on anything.
Yes, exactly. So they leap on it and turn it into a positive thing for their own ends, which is why I wouldn't have done it.
At what point, what I mean? I do. All right, philosophically, at what point do you stop punishing someone for something?
Well, it's not a punishment,
done?
Is it? Not getting an award for something that you aren't expecting to get is not a punishment.
Well, we'd have not been giving him an award because we were saying
was there nobody else that could have won it in the year? Was there not another cricketer that could have been one of the five?
Probably, but for the reasons I explained earlier.
But that's not a punishment. No, you know what I mean? If he didn't know that he was up for the award, how are you punishing him? By not getting it?
Because people would say, well, you're choosing people by cricketing standards, generally speaking, and he is definitely one of the five.
Okay.
On the Yorkshire racism story, there's an article by Azeem Rafiq that's front and centre.
Yeah, and thought he is the man of the year, really, in many ways. He's the catalyst for allowing a lot of people to speak about their own experiences. People typically, talking about people leaping on things. Well, the moment some of his old tweets came out, people leapt on him and said, oh, well, it invalidates everything he's gone through. Absolute nonsense. He was basically the guy who allowed other people to come out and talk about their own experiences. Now, I know some people argued that Yorkshire have gone about it the wrong way. There are still people trying to sue them for wrongful dismissal and so on. But the general, as a result of what Rafiq did, the general direction of travel at Yorkshire is positive. So I thought it was only right to give him his say about what happened. And David Hopps writes a sort of slightly more distance piece, if you like, about the whole Yorkshireness of the story. Which I felt it needed a kind of someone deeply involved and someone to take a step back. But Rafiq, he's one of the stars of this year's book.
Mm. We started the show talking about Joe Root's resignation and how difficult the end of his captaincy was, but he's also celebrated as the leading cricketer in the world. Just an incredible year with the bat.
Yeah, and I dare say people might say, well, you've got the recently, the guy who's just quit as England captain on the cover. Well, we put him on the cover because of his great year as a batsman. What was it? 1,708 runs, third highest annual tally, 1,200 runs clear of his nearest teammate, Rory Burns. So he's getting these runs in a struggling side. He's getting them in the fifth year of his captaincy, which is usually a time when England captains are sort of falling in a heap, understandably. And he, what, 600s? He's already added two more this year against the West Indies. Quite an easy choice for us, really. You know, you have to divide the captaincy from the batting. That's what we did.
Excellent. As I said, you can get the Wisden Almanac, which is out now on wisden.com/shop. Phil, there's a new Wisden Cricket Monthly out, also now. What's in it? You don't have Joe to go to.
No, I don't.
What is in it?
No, so I'm rudderless.
And I don't know what's in it either.
I'm rudderless at the best of times without Joe. My God. Well, this is how desperate I had to kind of go back and it's not out yet, you see. So it comes out actually on Friday this week.
Okay.
Because of the Easter weekend. It's
got
a day
it,
later.
Got it.
So it's Friday this week. And a week out from print, we didn't have a clue what was going in it. Obviously, English cricket was having one of its, you know, fortnightly crises. And so we didn't really know where we were. As it stands, we've pulled together a beauty. Now, I know I do tend to say that, but it's true in this instance. And I've actually got WhatsApp proof that I was saying to Joe afterwards what a cracker it is.
Do you mean you've lied about it in the past?
I might have exaggerated the truth, Mark.
I also like how your proof is a message that you sent saying it was really good before.
Yeah. Yeah. This is actually really bloody good, mate. Anyway, so from the top, the front page, the front cover is the impossible job question mark, Root.
Timed it well, yeah.
Root, Stokes, Broad, plus some ghosts from the past. You didn't make it, Mark. You only did it for a week. But some of these others, you know, Hangdog, Nasser in tears at a press conference and so on and so on. So anyway, John Stern goes through the eras, looks at the job itself and asks if it's basically more challenging and borderline impossible to do than at any other time. You know, of course, with COVID, with, you know, white ball interference and all the rest of it. And we go through the good, the bad, and the shockingly unrealistic options to replace Joe Root. Joey Harmon, incidentally, writes a page explaining why Joe Root should have carried on. Not always, it's not always current with the print magazine. That's just the nature of the beast. Mark Ramprakash joins us as a new columnist. Our other columnists, one of whom is sitting next to me here, we're all in very good form.
I'm a new columnist as well.
Pardon?
I'm a new columnist as well.
You are, and I was going to come to that at the end, you know, as the joke little bit at the end. But yeah, second team vice-captain of your club.
Newly appointed.
Yeah, so you're doing a kind of vice-captain's log, if you like, as the season rolls along. You're already fed up with it?
I'm not fed up with it.
Column one, it was bleak.
I've lost my excitement. I've realised that the job is more about just chasing people for availabilities. Yeah,
it's phoning people up, isn't it?
And receiving
phone calls from people saying, well, me and the lads are going off to Ibiza for the weekend. You're going to have to find somebody else, that sort of thing. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
You have to do much of that, sorry?
All the time.
More than you think. More Ryan
Apple. Just make the amount of times I'm having to think, well, what are we going to call this injury?
Andrew Miller, Lawrence Booth, Andy Zaltzman, Raph Nicholson wrote a really good piece actually on the back of England's stumble to the final, if you like, in the Women's World Cup. She reviews that really well actually. So a good list of names, and yourself, you've slipped in there as well. Taha is given an audience with Ramiz Raja, who is still, as we speak, hanging on as CEO at the PCB.
At the time of recording.
Haven't they just announced a new T20 comp for sort of like an age group competition in Pakistan?
I'm sure I saw
a tweet coming out of Pakistan saying that he's trying to get a sort of like an under 21s or something, you know, the under 19s T20 league off the ground, five teams or something in Pakistan, which I thought was interesting idea.
He's had quite a busy week.
He's quite a busy man.
Well, he was proposing the four team
quadrangular
tournament, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Pakistan, India, Australia, England.
Yeah.
And I think that was kicked out in the end.
And the idea would be that money from that would go to other ICC members, but it doesn't look like that's got support.
No, but again, Taha touches on that. He touches on the notorious Western bloc comments that he made regarding England's non-attendance and obviously Australia having now gone to Pakistan. That's a really interesting interview across his mahogany wood panel table.
Isn't that extraordinary? That sort of the team that has virtually refused to tour anywhere for the last God knows how many
suddenly ends up there.
Ends up being the sort of like, you know, the trailblazers for going back to Pakistan. Yeah. And England has sort of sat there humping away going, oh, well, that could have been us. So it's unbelievable, isn't it?
It was reported this week that Bangladesh are set to tour Australia in 2027. And I know that's 5 years away.
2027?
Yeah. I know that's 5 years away, but my initial thought was like, is that going to happen?
They'll find a reason to cancel it.
I'll just run through it very quickly. Inzamam's Cricket Life, really, really good interview by Saj Sadiq. I interviewed Craig Brathwaite, I mentioned last week. Yes. That was good fun. Somehow, Joe commissioned Jim Wallace to write 4 pages on the leave, and it actually works. The leave alone shot, four pages. Anyway, it works. Trevor Penny standing at the other end to Brian Lara when he made his 500. And loads of pages of county stuff. County Files is back with a bang and a bit of a whimper, because I'm doing them. Mickey Arthur, Critchley, James Harris, Ben Brown, Jigger Nake, Adam Rossington, and Rory Burns, all in the magazine, all interviews.
Matt Critchley.
Interesting player.
Matt Critchley.
One week into his Essex career, and Phil was already tipping him for England.
Well, I remember when I first saw him down at Derby on what I think are the best pitches in the country. I thought, mate, he can seriously bowl. Batting's not... is really good too. I mean, if there's one thing that sort of Matt Parkinson, bless him, has very much against him, it's that he's very one-dimensional as a cricket player. Matt Critchley is not. He's somebody you'd be keeping a very, very close eye on if you were chairman of selectors or Rob Key or virtually anyone, really, because
no one knows who they can
be. No one knows who they are. Yeah. So everybody keep an eye on Matt.
So yeah, it's Belter. Go and get it on Friday. Fantastic. Digital version Fantastic. As well. Couple
you're,
of quid.
You're going to do another voiceover advert.
Yes,
as
I
well
am. For, that was a Belter. Yeah,
absolutely.
Couple of quid an issue. Digital version drops into your phone or your iPad. And it's absolute beauty.
Fantastic. Well, that is all for today's show. Cheers, Phil. Thanks for joining us, Lawrence. Cheers, Butch. This has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week.
Sports Social Podcast Network.